the Clearly KC podcast, a podcast by the National Keratoconus Foundation, featuring information about life with keratoconus. I'm your host, Dr. Melissa Barnett. Today, I'm really excited to welcome Jason Marzak, who's an associate professor at the University of Houston College of Optometry, where his research over the last 20 years has focused on designing corrections for eyes of individuals with keratoconus. Jason has a somewhat unique perspective as a researcher in this area because he himself has keratoconus. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be here and really appreciate the work that y'all do with this podcast and all your other endeavors related to keratoconus. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on the Clearly KC podcast. We've had the great opportunity to work together over the years. Thank you for contributing to our book, Contemporary Scleral Lenses, Theory and Application. Share with us a little bit about your journey of keratoconus from diagnosis until now.
Sure. Maybe at the very beginning, I'll just give a couple of disclosures because they will hit into my story here. I'm funded by the National Eye Institute and the American Optometric Association. I also have commercial relationships with companies Wavefront Dynamics. We're developing a partnership with Cooper Vision as well. And we have some patents here at UH related to this technology. But today I'm just speaking as myself. I'm not representing any of these people or the university. And like you said, we're talk a little bit about my story. Actually, I called my parents this morning. I wanted to make sure and get this correct. So I called my parents and they confirmed the timeline a little bit. So I was diagnosed in 1996, around there, when I was a college student. And this is kind of the classic story of keratoconus. It hit me at a pivotal time where I was trying to figure out what I was going to do next, what I was going to do for a career. You know, I was probably what you might consider the typical difficult patient with keratoconus. I was searching for answers. I was seeking relief from something. And at the time, I guess I didn't really know what I was seeking, but I definitely saw many doctors. I was not satisfied, if that maybe rings a bell from you for clinically. And I remember I went to see a doctor in Austin when I was doing a master's degree at UT, and his name was Merle Jackman. And that visit, when I went to see him, it completely changed the trajectory of my career and my life. I thought what he was able to do in terms of providing me the correction, and I think he really more than anyone to that time just kind of listened to what I was saying, and he was willing to try some things that were maybe not what would be typical for keratoconus. He actually fit me in pure vision toric lenses. Okay. And I just have this recollection that the things I was searching for, it was like I had found them. You know, his solution filled this gap. And I remember very distinctly, days after this visit, I was walking to the lab and I just remember thinking, wow, I haven't thought about my vision in a couple hours. It's been a while. And that wasn't typical for me at the time. It was something that was kind of always on my mind.
Oh, wow.
And I remember that kind of focused what I wanted to do from that point forward. I thought to myself, I want to be, however I can be a part of the solution, I want to be a part of that for someone else. I want to change my focus. At the time, I was a biomedical engineer student at the University of Texas. And at that time, I changed. I came over to the University of Houston as a graduate student, and I've been here ever since. Again, trying to focus on these aspects of correcting the eye of keratoconus, trying to fill in, help others who are searching for something in that way. So yeah, that's how I got to where I am today.
Wow, that is so amazing. I've actually never heard your story like that. That's so cool. And how many years have you been at the University of Houston?
I've been here for, I think I came in 2002. So I guess that's roughly 23 years.
Wow.
And I had a 2-year period where I worked at Johnson Space Center down in Clear Lake. After my PhD, I went down there for a bit and then came back here. So all told, roughly 20 years. Here. But to be honest with you, it feels like about 2. It went by very quickly because I think when you find the community where you fit in, it makes it not like a job. If you it makes it not wonderful. Work. And I'm sure you feel the same way. You know, how can it have been actually 20 years?
I know. It's amazing. It is. It is so much fun. And I'm a little biased, but I think eye care is the best. And I think that we have just a wonderful community.
Oh, for sure. It really is an amazing collection of people working on hard problems that affect people's everyday life. So it's really kind of an honor to get to do it.
It sure is. I actually ran across one of your recent publications that I'd love to hear more about. And that is the visual acuity prediction based on different refraction types for patients with Down syndrome. Please share a bit about that publication.
Yeah, that work is led by Dr. Heather Anderson. She's at The Ohio State University, and we have a really great team of individuals that works on that project. The main focus for that is, you know, individuals with Down syndrome, it can be very difficult in the clinic because some of the cognitive difficulties they have participating in the eye exam. You can think about the use of the phoropter and subjective refraction, and that's a hard task for anybody. The decisions, I think, that we're asked, which of these two is better, and there's like these very slight differences that you're making judgments on, that's a difficult task. In Down syndrome, there does tend to be some cognitive difficulty that makes that harder. But with Down syndrome, these individuals also have elevated aberrations, you know? So to some degree, if you wanted to think about it as a continuum, I think what we found was that if you think about typically sighted individuals as having a low level of aberrations in the eye, and keratoconus patients as having a higher level of aberrations in the eye, individuals with Down syndrome are somewhere in the middle. So this makes these techniques like subjective refraction very difficult, even more challenging. The work that we're doing is looking at objective measures based on these aberrations and leveraging prior work that has shown that some of these visual image quality metrics, the change that you see in visual image quality is related to a change in acuity. What we're trying to do is basically leverage these changes in the objective measure of the visual image quality for an eye and try and provide the best optical correction we can for these patients. Essentially, we're taking the subjective nature of the refraction out of it. They don't have to provide answers, which is better, one or two, and guide the clinician. We can measure the eye, and with this visual image quality metric, we can basically optimize their visual image quality by providing them a specific spherocylindrical refraction.
Wow, that's so fantastic. So on a prior episode of this podcast, we were talking about Down syndrome and visual quality, but you're coming up with the solutions, which is absolutely amazing. When are we going to see this in clinical practice?
Well, yeah, Mary asked me the same question about wavefront guided refractions before we hopped on. I think it's a scientific question, but it's also a clinical practice question. I think when you think about any of these novel approaches to solutions, a lot of it is when we do research, we're thinking about in general in the population, how does the performance of the population shift on average? I think for something like this to become mainstream, there's more work that needs to be done on individualizing the benefit. How can you predict the benefit for an individual rather than a group as a whole? Right. So that's work that needs to be done. But the other thing I think that underpins keratoconus work, as well as this Down syndrome work, which is, again, really work in a population with elevated aberrations, is we need to make measurement of the aberrations in the clinic more routine. You know, when you think about aberrations, I think most practitioners and most people working in those environments know about aberrations, but I don't think they're things we measure routinely. So there's this blind spot to the aberrations, to the fact that people are suffering from these visually important aberrations other than sphere and sill.
For our listeners, for those who don't know what aberrations are, can you explain that, please?
Sure. Well, I think most people who have been to the eye doctor are familiar with the subjective refraction, which is better one or two. And this is a process that will identify a pair of glasses and potentially contact lenses, the optical prescription of which corrects for aberrations, sphere and cylinder. These are the common type of aberrations we correct for with standard glasses and contact lenses. Prism also can go into that category, but it's a little bit different. We use it for a little bit different reasons. So we'll just say sphere and cylinder. But when you talk about individuals like you were asking about with the Down syndrome population and the population with keratoconus, these groups have optical aberrations other than sphere and cylinder that are visually important. I should say all eyes, all typically sighted individuals, all eyes of all people have these other aberrations. They're just at a low level where they don't influence to a large degree the individual's their visual percept. So I think we could easily achieve an age-matched level of acuity by correcting sphere and sill in the typical population. But when you talk about an individual with maybe Down syndrome or keratoconus, these other aberrations, what we would call higher order aberrations, the amount of them starts to creep up. So that even if you correct sphere and cylinder, these other aberrations will remain uncorrected and they will degrade the retinal image and therefore the visual percept of the individual. So again, since the subjective refraction process, like use of a phoropter, doesn't quantify these aberrations, they sometimes go unnoticed. So maybe in the clinical sense, the individual may not be performing as you like, or they may have these complaints that they continue to have. And part of that could be due to the fact that they have these other aberrations that we can't really see. We're not measuring.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That was very clear. Changing subjects a little bit, I would love to get your perspective on the keratoconus personality. So we hear about this. There have been multiple studies. We had a study here at UC Davis. So what do you think drives the clinical perception that keratoconus patients are somehow different from other types of patients?
Yeah, like I said in the beginning, I think if you had seen me in the early days, I would probably be this, what you might consider the classic keratoconus personality. I was an engineer. And just as a rule, I think engineers can be challenging, you know, worrying about that 1 degree of cylinder axis or whatever it happens to be. But I think if we classify the keratoconus personality as someone who, maybe if we put a positive spin on it, is they're continuing to try and meet an unmet need of their own. They're trying to seek out a solution for a problem that they perceive that they have. From the other side of the chair, it might be, oh, this patient tends to be a little bit difficult. I tend to look at it like they're trying to fill an unmet need. Mm-hmm. I wonder if this need wouldn't, if this kind of personality would not manifest in any group where a gap in technology existed. So for instance, if I were to say to a clinician, if you had a typically sighted group, if you brought 1,000 typical patients in, but the optical corrections you provided to them were only in 2 diopter steps. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we know that for the majority of these patients, we're leaving some residual sphere uncorrected. Would some of those present as being difficult, or would they continue to seek a solution? And I think the answer is yes. Or if you only had sphere lenses and you tried to fit the astigmatic population with only the spherical equivalent, would they continue to seek more? And I think, again, the answer is yes. And I think that's exactly what's happening in keratoconus, and not just on the optical dimension. I think that the current solutions for keratoconus in the clinic are absolutely amazing. They're a miracle. They make individuals functional that might not otherwise be. I think if we think about the dimensions of optical correction and these higher order aberrations, or perhaps the wear time of the solution, or the expense of the solution, or the chair time, I think there's a technology gap, and they are continuing to seek to get that gap filled. I don't know if that resonates with you as a clinician.
Oh, it definitely resonates as a clinician. And what I find is another gap is the importance of empathy when yes. It comes to keratoconus, and really listening to the story and hearing the journey, because everyone has their own journey. And when I have a patient who comes in, I like to listen and really understand where they've been, what brought them to me, and hear their story. So the wonderful thing about the National Keratoconus Foundation is that we have resources. We have so many different resources. And there's literature that I can share with my patients. They love that there's actually a community. I have patients who've never met anyone with keratoconus. And I always joke, just sit out in the waiting area. You'll make some friends. Sometimes they get talking, but keratoconus is actually so common. But many people have had such a journey. So I think that we need to talk about the psychology of keratoconus a little bit more. We need to talk about the importance of empathy. And I would love to get your perspective as well, your unique perspective. What can practitioners do today to try and empathize with their patients who are diagnosed with keratoconus?
So it's really interesting. Sometimes I don't often get a chance to talk about these. Usually we're dealing with the math and the numbers and measuring things. And so this is a really interesting conversation for me to have. Your point about the isolation, I think that's very true. And I certainly felt that in my early days. And coming to U of H and working here, I think I was able to see a much larger picture that some patients may never see, that they are not the only ones, that there's a lot of people out there. And where I saw that most was we did a National Keratoconus Family Day in Houston, where we had National Keratoconus Foundation brought together resources. We had families come. In the beginning of the meeting with the organization, there was a lot of doctors and scientists, and we were giving all these resources. And I was kind of envisioning the whole day would be delivery to the group. But over the course of the day, what I saw was that the patients started to huddle up and communicate with each other and talk about their experiences. And we, as the people giving the information, we were no longer, our material was not the focus. They were talking with each other. And I really thought that was a great outcome of that event. So yeah, that kind of isolation, it is important for patients to know that a lot of people deal with this. And again, I think from the perspective of what I think clinicians might do, I think your point about empathy is a good one. One of the challenges I think with empathy is that it's hard to empathize when you don't have a sense of what the actual problem for the patient is. And I think, again, if you think about it one-dimensionally from an optics problem, and it's more than that, but if we just think about that, since we don't measure aberrations routinely in the clinic, we can't really know what the patient's dealing with other than what they tell us, right? We can hear their words. But I think if we were, again, more routinely measuring these patients and their aberrations, even in the absence of an ability to do anything about it, even if we can't correct them, if we were measuring them, I think that would really go a long way towards understanding the consequence of their disease. You know, we do a lot of research here where we try and correct aberrations for patients. And one of the more impactful situations we had was a patient who was 20/20 with his habitual correction, but he was very unhappy with that. And you kind of wonder, how can a patient be unhappy with 20/20 vision? That's confusing. But if you measure the residual or uncorrected aberrations, the higher order aberrations which persisted even while they were wearing their correction, then it became clear. Like, okay, this patient has a lot of residual uncorrected aberrations. They're able to read down the chart to that 20/20 line. So quantitatively, they may be in that typical range, but qualitatively, they're still suffering.
Right. So, I always call that a blurry 20/20, the operations. And I think, it's not a good, crisp quality of vision.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely blurry. But also, I think that one of the things that the subjects can be challenging is like the aberrations in the two eyes of the same patient can be very asymmetric.
Yes.
They're consistently presented with these two images. So if you think about the phoropter, if we're asking patients, which is better, one or two, some of these patients might be going through their whole life asking that question with their two eyes, which is better, one or two. They're looking through and they're seeing kind of these asymmetric quality of vision between their two eyes. So I think that even when all the clinical signs, like reading down the chart or whatever, are telling you that the patient should be happy, some of these residual uncorrected errors can have significant impact on quality of life. And I think they influence what we consider the keratoconus personality.
Oh, that's so insightful. I completely agree. So what's your hope for the future of clinical care for patients with KC?
Yeah, I have a couple and some of them are not realistic, but I hope, like any disease, someone figures out how to cure it so that people don't suffer from it. That person won't be me. I was talking with someone about this the other day, actually, for students who are interested in working in the lab. You know, we don't really work on why people have keratoconus or how to not have keratoconus. We only deal with trying to help them once they have it. So yeah, it would be great if someone figured that out, but it won't be me. When I think about this disease, I think about the 12-year-old that's out there right now. They're in middle school today. Maybe right now as we're doing this, they're in some math class or whatever, and they see well at the board. But maybe in 5 years or 7 years or whatever, maybe they're starting to wear glasses. And then eventually at some point, they're told they have keratoconus. My hope for at least the work we're doing, and a lot of people, not just me or our lab, I hope we're ready for that person. I hope we're ready when they are eventually diagnosed with this condition, that we are ready to provide them with the choice that allows them to fill the gap that maybe patients earlier in time couldn't fill. I would hope that they experience, they go in, and then they continue on the path which they chose, that it's not changing some of the choices they might make otherwise. And I think we're all going that way a long way. I think scleral lenses and the research that's happening and more choices are available to people. I hope that we continue to move these forward and more choices available to those individuals.
And Jason, I hope that from a practitioner perspective that we're looking for keratoconus in every single patient. I do believe that we need to rule out keratoconus just like we need to rule out dry eye in every patient that we see. So for all the practitioners out there, please evaluate for keratoconus in that 12-year-old, in that 17-year-old, in the 35-year-old. You know, we've had discussions to just be on the lookout for. It is actually much more common than we ever knew before.
For sure. I think the detection, the ability to detect the disease is increasing. We're able to identify those individuals much more than in the past. Absolutely. Can I add one last thing? I hope that science and clinical practice keep moving forward to provide additional resources for patients. I think the thing I would want maybe patients to know right now, because again, we talked about it can be isolating. Mm-hmm. I think if you were to take 100 people with keratoconus and put them in a room, and then you were to ask somebody, okay, all these individuals have a common condition, what is it? The majority of people wouldn't say vision because they wear contact lenses and you wouldn't appear to the outside world that is what they suffer from. So it is isolating. And I hope that patients know that there are a lot of people who are dedicated to this area, to improving care in the clinic and in science. I want the patients to know when they wake up and they're putting on their contact lenses, there are people in the world working on these problems. They are dedicated to this. People like yourself, Dr. Barnett. I could go on. We could do a whole podcast on people who are just working in this area, trying to improve these things. So that's not to give false hope, but I do think it's important to give hope that, you know, people are dedicated to solving these problems.
Well, thank you for all your dedication and all your work. And thank you, Jason, so much for sharing your personal perspective with us. I've worked with you a lot on the scientific perspective and writing and talking about optics, but not so much on the personal level. So really appreciate that. Thank you for your willingness to share with others. And for all of our listeners, thank you so much for joining us on Clearly KC. Please listen to all of the episodes of the Clearly KC podcast on Podbean or your favorite podcast app. And for now, I'm Dr. Melissa Barnett. See you next time on Clearly KC.